It alone can get life into motion, since it springs from life. Terence recognized the power of enthusiasm when he said, "You believe that easily which you hope for earnestly." James A. Garfield expressed his understanding of enthusiasm in these words, "If wrinkles must be written upon our brows, let them not be written upon the heart. The spirit should not grow old." He understood that the heart is the seat of enthusiasm, the source of emotional feeling. Tacitus said, "Adversity has no friends," and he spoke the truth, but he might well have said that adversity discourages friendships because it usually sours the emotions and dampens enthusiasm. Froebel revealed his deep understanding of the power of enthusiasm when he said, "The delusive idea that men merely toil and work for the sake of their bodies and procuring for themselves bread, houses, and clothes is degrading and not to be encouraged. The true origin of man's activities is his unceasing impulse to embody outside himself the divine and ritual element within him." Those who are informed in metaphysics know that material circumstances mean nothing, that material circumstances shape themselves to fit the state of one's mind as naturally as water flows downhill in response to the law of gravitation. The metaphysicist knows that the death of a dear friend or loved one need not bring sorrow, but it may serve as an inspiration to nobler efforts and deeper thinking through the principle of transmutation of emotional feeling. Emerson revealed his understanding of metaphysics in the following expressions of his thought. "A fever, a mutilation, a cruel disappointment, a loss of wealth, a loss of friends seems at the moment unpaid loss and unpayable, but the sure years reveal the deep remedial force that underlies all facts. The death of a dear friend, wife, brother, lover, which seemed nothing but privation, somewhat later assumes the aspect of a guide or genius, for it commonly operates revolutions in our way of life, terminates an epoch of infancy or youth which was waiting to be closed, breaks up a wanted occupation or a household or style of living, and allows the formation of new ones more friendly to the growth of character. It permits or constrains the formation of new acquaintances, and the reception of new influences that prove of the first importance to the next years, and the man or woman who would have remained a sunny garden flower, with no room for its roots and too much sunshine for its head, by the falling of the walls and the neglect of the gardener, is made the banyan of the forest, yielding shade and fruit to wide neighborhoods of men." One cannot get the full benefit of this chapter without recognizing the close relationship between positive and negative emotions, and the astounding possibilities of conversion of the negative into the positive. Once this possibility is understood, it will become clear that the confirmed pessimist may, by a change of his mental attitude, become a profound optimist, with the ability to express enthusiasm in exact proportion that he expressed pessimism. Mr. Carnegie has made frequent references to the desirability of one's taking possession of his own mind. We know some minds which are so negative that we would not recommend that their owners take possession of them, but we would recommend that they convert them from the negative to the positive, then take possession of them. The possession of a negative mind is a costly possession. Mr. Carnegie intended to have made this clear when he admonished people to take possession of their own minds. He had reference, of course, to the potentialities of a positive mind. Mary Baker Eddy described this same thought, in different terminology, when she said, "We know that a statement proved to be good must be correct. Now thoughts are constantly obtaining the floor. These two theories, that all is matter or that all is mind, will dispute the ground until one is acknowledged the victor." Discussing his campaign, General Grant said, "I propose to fight it out on this line, if it takes all summer. Science says, all is mind and mind's idea. You must fight it out on this line. Matter can afford you no aid. Harmony is produced by its principle, is controlled by it. Divine principle is the life of man. Man's happiness is not, therefore, at the disposal of physical sense. Truth is not contaminated by error. Harmony in man is as beautiful as in music, and discord as unnatural, unreal." If I interpreted Mrs. Eddy's thought accurately, she said, substantially, that the energy of thought is good or bad, negative or positive, only because of the use one makes of it, through one's mental attitude. There is but one kind of thought. It can be given many kinds of expression, either negative or positive. Reasoning on that simple premise, one can easily see that any negative emotion can be changed into a positive expression that may be helpful. In this possibility may one find the most profound application of enthusiasm. The same energy that brings the pain of sorrow may be converted and made to bring the joy of creative action in connection with one's definite major purpose or some minor purpose. Here is where self-discipline comes to one's aid. Only the disciplined mind can transmute sorrow into joy. The art of converting negative emotion into positive expression is acquired by the formation of habits designed to coordinate the action of the mind with the action of the body. In this respect, college athletes have much in their favor, for it is a well-known fact that an enthusiastic athlete may easily convert his enthusiasm from athletics to any sort of occupational endeavor he chooses. Tennis provides the very finest of media through which habits of coordination between the mind and body may be formed, and for this reason, if for no other, tennis should become the national game for all people, both the young and the older people. The man who has the bad habit of allowing his mind to use up energy in connection with worry will find tennis an excellent medium through which to convert his worries into enthusiastic courage. An hour on the tennis court, applied vigorously, will leave little room in one's mind for worry. Athletic training has another benefit. It develops the habit of clean sportsmanship as well as the habit of enthusiasm, and life calls for both of these qualities if one is to enjoy the greatest measure of success. Anything that creates temporary harmony in one's mind tends also to develop enthusiasm. The musician can exchange his worries for enthusiastic courage with the aid of his favorite musical instrument, and do it quickly. One famous author spends his rest time, between working spells of about 1 hour each, at his piano. Very often he does nothing but run the musical scales, but the coordination between his hands and his mind gives him rest and renews his energy. As Mr. Carnegie appropriately stated, this question of coordination between the mind and the body, through some form of vigorous action, is one of the surest and quickest ways of preparing the mind for enthusiasm. Dancing is another excellent form of exercise through which coordination between the mind and the body prepares the way for enthusiasm. I have heard an experienced teacher of dancing say that this form of exercise has been used successfully in treating patients suffering with mental disorders. The benefit comes, doubtlessly, because the rhythm of the dancing tends to clear the mind of complexes and fears, thus providing temporary expression of enthusiasm. This theory harmonizes perfectly with Mr. Carnegie's views. The author has trained himself, over a long period of years, to think on his typewriter. The moment he touches the keys, his mind begins to function with enthusiasm, his imagination becomes more alert, and ideas begin to flow in a steady stream. On many occasions, he has endeavored to think through a theme before beginning to express his thoughts in writing, only to discover that his thoughts were lacking in fluency. On some occasions, he has found it necessary to begin writing, perhaps on some subject foreign to that on which he was thinking, until his mind warmed up and enthusiasm began to appear. On other occasions, he has found it necessary to tear up the first 8 or 10 pages of his manuscript and rewrite it because he lacked enthusiasm at the beginning. This experience harmonizes perfectly with the experience of the public speaker who finds it difficult to express himself brilliantly until he warmed up his mind through the first 5 or 10 minutes of his speech. Athletes have similar experiences. That is why they go through the familiar warming up process before beginning the game. They cannot play their best until there is sufficient coordination between the mind and the body to produce enthusiasm. The condition is entirely mental, not physical. Remember, therefore, that the first step one should take in transmuting negative thought into positive action is some form of physical action that is coordinated with one's thoughts. What enthusiasm is and what it does. Let me briefly describe the more important effects of enthusiasm. Mr. Carnegie has already presented an outline of the major destroyers of this essential quality of the mind. What, then, does enthusiasm do? 1. Enthusiasm steps up the vibrations of thought and thereby makes the faculty of the imagination more alert. 2. It clears the mind of negative emotions and thus paves the way for the development of faith. 3. It radiates confidence and sincerity. 4. It gives a pleasing color to the tone of the voice. 5. It helps to take the drudgery out of work. 6. It adds to the attractiveness of personality. 7. It inspires self-confidence. 8. It aids in the maintenance of sound health. 9. When accompanied by appropriate physical action, enthusiasm becomes of major importance as a medium for transmuting negative emotion into positive emotion. 10. It gives the necessary force to one's desires to influence the subconscious section of the mind to act upon them promptly. It is believed by some psychologists that the subconscious mind acts only on thoughts that are emotionalized, although the emotion may be either negative or positive. Other attributes of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is the major factor which converts an order taker into a master salesman. It takes the dryness out of public speech by establishing harmony between the speaker and his audience. Thus, it is an indispensable quality in the work of anyone whose occupation depends, for its success, upon the spoken word. The enthusiastic speaker takes charge of his audience at will. It gives brilliancy to the spoken word, and there is considerable ground for the belief that it may enable a speaker to avail himself, directly, through the subconscious mind, of the power of infinite intelligence. There is no doubt that it gives one an alert memory. But, far and away, the two most important functions of enthusiasm are these. It definitely serves as the major factor in converting negative emotion into positive emotion, and it prepares the mind for the development of faith. Compared with these, all other functions of enthusiasm are inconsequential. As Mr. Carnegie has stated, enthusiasm is the result of motive. One cannot become enthusiastic without a cause. Enthusiasm, therefore, is an important factor in carrying out the object of one's definite major purpose. It is no less an asset, of course, in attaining one's minor purposes. Enthusiasm is the action factor of thought. Where it is strong enough, it literally forces one into physical action appropriate to the nature which inspired it. I believe, therefore, that Mr. Carnegie appropriately emphasized the importance of the relationship between enthusiasm and physical action. The development of enthusiasm without appropriate physical action is something like exploding a charge of dynamite in open air, where nothing happens except a loud noise. By moving promptly through some form of appropriate physical action when inspired by enthusiasm, one develops the habit of enthusiasm. A splendid way to begin this habit is by injecting enthusiasm into the spoken word. Here is a starting point within reach of everyone. It is one habit which requires no preparation to begin it. Start where you stand and begin now to train yourself to speak with enthusiasm, no matter to whom you are speaking or for what purpose. This habit will overcome timidity. It will inspire greater self-confidence. It will develop initiative. Train yourself not only to speak with enthusiasm, but to inject a pleasing tone into your voice. Loud talk without controlled tone may become nothing but offensive noise. Learn to dramatize words so they carry the exact meaning you intend them to carry. Nothing is more essential for success than effective speech. Speech is not effective if it is without color and enthusiasm. You will be surprised at the improvement you can make in your speech within a single week, if you will make a studied effort to inject emotional feeling into every word you speak. Enunciate clearly. Speak each word separately. Do not run your words together by speaking some of them so inaudibly they can barely be heard. Speak out clearly and distinctly, and put force behind every word. One of the common evils of most people is careless speech. Remember that your manner of speech gives others a perfect clue as to the workings of your mind and the nature of your character. Here is one method by which you can acquire the habit of coordinating your thoughts with the physical action of speech. Within a month's time, you can so improve your manner of speech that you will hardly be recognized by your acquaintances when you speak. This habit will become one of the more beneficial media for the development of self-discipline. For obviously, there is no form of self-discipline that is more essential for success than discipline over one's spoken words. Most people talk too much, talk too carelessly, and say too little that is of advantage to them. Discipline over speech will overcome this fault. Thus it will have served the double purpose of eliminating a fault and developing a virtue through a single effort. You can carry on your discipline over speech in all your conversations without anyone knowing that you are doing so. Begin with the members of your own family. Continue with your friends and acquaintances. Make it a part of your daily routine never to speak a single word that has not been studied and carefully modified before you speak it. Use words sparingly, as if they cost you $5 a word. Never speak just to hear the sound of your own voice or to impress others with your wisdom. Speak only to convey such thoughts as you wish others to receive from you, and be sure to put the exact feeling into your words that you wish the listener to interpret. There is enough sound advice in the preceding paragraph to make the difference between success and failure for many people. It is one of the tragedies of the age in which we live that the advice is one badly needed by a majority of the people. If it is true that talk is cheap, it may be true because the speaker himself is small. Remember this before you speak. Observe with benefit to yourself how sparingly successful men use words. They seldom engage in what is known as light conversations. Profanity is not on their vocabulary list. They spend no time in idle gossip. They do no slandering of other people. When they speak, they generally say something that is worth hearing. The man who has a steady flow of carelessly spoken words seldom has anything else. He is usually not among the successful. Time, to him, is something to be killed, but it is nothing more. He intrudes himself into conversations without either cause or invitation, and too frequently he will monopolize the conversation. If he has enthusiasm, it is wasted because his words will have no beneficial influence with anyone. I'm emphasizing the subject of speech because speech is the major means of expressing enthusiasm. Let us not foul this great outlet for enthusiasm with cheap talk that has no purpose. There is no place where definiteness of purpose is more appropriate than it is in connection with speech. Words that have no purpose might better have been left unspoken. The business of living, of mastering obstacles and attaining a modest degree of success, is a serious business. It requires all of one's time and effort. No one has even a minute he can afford to waste in idle talk or careless speech. It is no mere accident that only a few people succeed in making life pay on their own terms, while the vast majority go through life as failures. Analyze the use people make of their time, and you will observe the cause of both success and failure. Successful people work with definiteness of purpose and devote all their time, in a spirit of enthusiasm, to the attainment of that purpose. The failures devote their time to eating, sleeping, doing as little work as they can get by with, and purposeless talk. The difference in the ability of men is not the determining factor of their success or failure. It is the use they make of their ability that counts. One of the strange circumstances of many who fail is the fact that if they had gone one single step further, they might have succeeded instead. Every successful person I have analyzed acknowledged that he would have failed innumerable times if he had not kept on when overtaken by defeat. The person who is driven by an obsessional enthusiasm is not so apt to accept temporary defeat for failure. His will to win is greater than his willingness to quit. If enthusiasm did nothing else except sustain one in the times of defeat, it would justify all the time that is necessary to cultivate it. Enthusiasm is one quality that is indispensable to the man who has made up his mind to attain a high goal in life. It is the quality that helps him convert defeat into renewed effort. I had an interview with Thomas A. Edison which disclosed the great inventor's power of enthusiasm. It also provided a significant suggestion as to the value of the mastermind principle in the development of enthusiasm. Let us see what the great Edison had to say on this subject. "Mr. Edison," I began, "you have given the world the talking machine, the moving picture, incandescent electric light, and a score of other useful mechanical devices. And now I have come to ask you to give to the world the secret by which you mastered discouragement and temporary defeat while you were perfecting these conveniences." Edison made no reply. I turned red in the face and looked around to see if anyone could explain the inventor's silence, when Mr. Meadowcroft, Edison's secretary, broke in, saying, "I'm sorry I did not tell you, but Mr. Edison is deaf. You have to write your questions on a piece of paper." From there on, the interview moved smoothly. The question was repeated in writing, and Edison began by asking, Where shall I begin? Begin with your early boyhood, if you do not mind, I replied, and tell me about your schooling. Oh, my schooling, eh? Well, I suppose you know that my teacher sent me home from school after I had been in school only 3 months, with a note saying I did not have enough sense to take a schooling, and there is where my book learning stopped. But I guess this turn of events was fortunate, because it saved me the time that I might have spent in useless study of abstract rules and forced me to begin school in the greatest of all educational institutions, the University of Hard Knocks. You know that education comes from surmounting difficulties, the inventor continued, and not from reading about them. I asked Edison to tell the story of how Edwin C. Barnes had managed to start as a clerk in the Edison offices and lift himself to the status of a business partner. Edison grinned broadly as he began the story. Perhaps Ed Barnes should tell you about this himself, but I will give you a part of the story. One day I looked up from my work and saw a young man standing there with a suitcase in his hands. Meadowcroft said the young man had arrived on a freight train, and he looked as if he had. Then Ed took over the conversation by explaining that he had come a long way to go to work for me, and he said he would start anywhere. I put him to work, but he wanted me to know that sooner or later he was going to become a business partner of mine. I looked him over from head to foot, very carefully. I must have embarrassed him very much because he spoke right up and said, "You know, I do not have to work, Mr. Edison. I could starve to death if I wanted to." This made a hit with me, because the lad's eyes flashed with the fire of enthusiasm that marked him as one who would never quit until he got what he went after. I gave him a job sweeping floors, and that is all I ever had a chance to give him, because he kept me busy receiving from him after that, until he finally gave himself a partnership with me, installing Ediphones. When you talk to Barnes, ask him about his suits of clothes. He has 31 of them, you know, one for each day of the month. He said he needs them to stimulate enthusiasm. Those who believe jobs are hard to get and complain about not having pull enough to get a chance at the better positions will do well to remember how the only business partner Thomas A. Edison ever had found his chance. Certainly it was not by accepting difficulty as anything more than a stepping stone. Certainly it was not by doing as little work as he could get by with. Edison said, "I gave him a job sweeping floors, and that is all I ever had a chance to give him." In this sentence may be found an idea of great value to all who have personal services for sale. Pushing away from the Barnes story, I asked Mr. Edison if he had not found his deafness to be a great handicap. As quick as a blast, Edison shot back this reply, "No, it is no handicap. It is a blessing. A great blessing, I might say. It saves me the annoyance of listening to a lot of useless chatter from people who have nothing to say and take plenty of time saying it. The loss of my hearing forced me to acquire the habit of listening from within, where I found an approach to a source of knowledge from which most of my inventions came." "Was it true," I asked, "that you lost your hearing as a result of a cuff on the ears by an irate conductor of a railroad who became angry because you accidentally set the baggage car on fire?" "Yes," Edison replied, "that is the way it happened. Years afterward, I saw the conductor and thanked him for what he did." The interview swung back to the invention of the talking machine. "It has been said that you were several years perfecting the first talking machine. Will you state, Mr. Edison, whether this is true?" "No," Mr. Edison replied. "I succeeded in making a piece of wax revolving on a cylinder pick up and record the words, 'Mary had a little lamb,' the first time I tried it." "Will you state what gave you the idea of a talking machine? Didn't you feel that you were wasting your time?" "Something from inside me, inspiration, something like a hunch, kept telling me to keep on trying and I would find what I was seeking. As strange as it may seem, I found the secret very close to where I began looking for it, and with the aid of the self-same crude apparatus with which I began my experiments. For years after the first sound had been recorded and reproduced on this machine, it was used as a sort of model, and all commercial talking machines were patterned after it." "Am I to understand from your remarks, Mr. Edison," I asked, "that you believe there is a source of knowledge outside of that which is known to men through experience, and aside from that which has been recorded in books?" "If there hadn't been such a source of knowledge," the inventor replied, "the first talking machine never would have been perfected, for you must remember it was the first. I had no precedent to follow. No one else had left any information on the subject to guide me. The secret of recording and reproducing the vibration of sound was literally yielded up to me from a source of knowledge not generally known to men. "Will you state what you believe this hidden source of knowledge to be?" I asked. "And is it available to all who wish to use it?" "I have a theory about this. Perhaps it is something more than a mere theory, because I have tested it many times, but I doubt that I can describe it so you can accept it. The theory is that all knowledge exists in the form of energy, as a part of the great energy known as the ether, and this higher source can be reached only by those who have the willpower and faith to project their conscious thoughts through persistent concentration, until those thoughts connect with this higher source of vibration in which all knowledge is recorded. You know, of course," the inventor continued, "that Dr. Elmer Gates has discovered that he can sit in a dark room with his mind concentrated on the known factors of an unfinished invention until he forces the unknown factors to present themselves in the form of thoughts. He does not always succeed, but he does succeed often enough to enable him to earn his living by sitting for ideas for some of the best-known corporations. Moreover, he has completed over 100 inventions begun by other inventors who could not quite make them work, by sitting for the answer to his demand for the unknown elements." The inventor was becoming rather profound for a young writer, but subsequent interviews with Dr. Elmer Gates proved that Mr. Edison's statements were true. Mr. Edison said that when he found the solution to his problem while working on the incandescent electric lamp, he did so by bringing together two old, well-known principles and coordinating them in a way never tried previously, and that the idea came to him as a hunch just after he had dozed off for a few minutes of sleep, after a hard day's work in search of the solution. The principles were old, as Mr. Edison said, but the combination in which they were brought together was new. It came to Mr. Edison from that great hidden source of knowledge which he described as the source to which he always turned when organized knowledge, gained by men's experience and his own experiments, failed to yield the answer to his problems. This leads one to wonder if Mr. Edison did not come very near uncovering the source from which the needed knowledge for man's next big step upward in civilization will come. It also leads one to wonder if he did not uncover, in what he termed the hidden source of knowledge, something of great value to educators who are interested in helping man to use his mind more intelligently. Remember, this interview took place with one of the great inventors of the world, and not with a long-haired soapbox promulgator of ideas designed to be of help to others. I was interested in knowing how Mr. Edison managed to become a great scientist without at least an elementary knowledge of mathematics, chemistry, and physics. "How did you manage to get by without an elementary schooling?" I asked Mr. Edison. The reply was illuminating. With a twinkle in his eyes, the inventor replied, "Men with technical training can be employed. They have had plenty of elementary training, you know, but I rarely had to call upon them. The majority of my inventions were completed by the use of common horse sense, plus persistence, plus definite knowledge of what I wanted to accomplish. Most people do not know what they want. Schooling would do them no good, no matter how much of it they had. The biggest factor in the perfection of the talking machine was the definite knowledge of what was wanted. I saw that machine in my mind before I did a lick of work to create it. And what was more important, I made up my mind to make a machine record and reproduce the words, 'Mary had a little lamb,' if it took the rest of my life to do it. There never was any doubt that I would perfect a machine that would do this, and this certainty of purpose led also to certainty of plans and persistence of effort, which are two of the essentials of success in any undertaking. If you can convey this one thought to people trying to find success, you will render them a greater service than any they can get in most schools." The public has heard many different versions of the relationship which formerly existed between Edison, Henry Ford, Harvey S. Firestone, and John Burroughs. I asked Mr. Edison to describe the influence which bound these four men together so closely for so many years. "Was it friendship alone which brought Mr. Ford, Mr. Firestone, Mr. Burroughs, and yourself together?" I asked. "Not friendship alone," he replied. "It was something deeper than mere friendship. We found our association provided a source of thought stimulation that was helpful to each of us. Burroughs, you know, was a thought provoker. I think that we all received useful ideas from his fertile brain." "Wherever two or more people coordinate their minds in a spirit of harmony," Mr. Edison continued, "each person experiences a form of mind stimulation which lifts his thoughts above those of the average workaday type of thought. This fact was responsible for the coining of the term round table, as it is a well-known fact that whenever a group of men sit down and begin seriously and harmoniously to discuss any subject, there comes from the discussion ideas, plans, and knowledge of the subject not previously known to any person in the group. The principle Mr. Edison was describing was the mastermind, through which men avail themselves of the knowledge of others without the necessity of gaining that knowledge through experiences of their own. Mr. Edison explained that he made use of this principle freely, in connection with his work as an inventor, and stated that it was through the use of this principle that he bridged the deep chasm caused by his lack of elementary schooling. Andrew Carnegie described the principle of the mastermind as being responsible, more than all the other principles of individual achievement, for the accumulation of his great fortune, and Dr. Gates acknowledged it as the principle through which he perfected hundreds of inventions. Mr. Edison emphasized the fact that only minds that are coordinated in a spirit of perfect harmony can get the full benefit of this principle. The reminder is significant. It was Mr. Edison's description of the principle of the mastermind which inspired me to turn the spotlight of attention upon this principle so persistently that it led me to the discovery that the principle has been used, either consciously or unconsciously, by every person who has attained outstanding success in any calling. Since the first interview I had with the great Edison, the maps of the world have been rewritten, and the economic depression has changed the habits and the fortunes of men all over the world. But the 17 principles of achievement, some of which Mr. Edison used, remain the same, and these are times favorable to those who understand and apply these principles. The depression left millions of men without positions. Perhaps many of them have tried and failed several times since the depression began. To all such, it will be helpful if they will remember that the great inventor of Orange, New Jersey, tried and failed 10,000 times before he perfected the incandescent electric lamp. Some of those who lost their positions during the Depression may profit by remembering the spirit of Ed Barnes, who was so determined to become the partner of Mr. Edison that he went to Orange, New Jersey by freight train and was willing to begin as a floor sweeper. It pays now, as it paid young Barnes over 30 years ago, to know what one wants and to be willing to stand by one's plan until the end is achieved. Mr. Edison taught the world great lessons, not the least of them the fact that success comes to the person who refuses to accept anything else. Edison was in no way discouraged after failing 10,000 times. The average man would have quit at the first signs of failure, let alone at the end of 10,000 failures, which explains why there are so many average men, and there was but one Edison. Mr. Edison's plans often failed, just as the plans of other men failed. When one plan failed, with determination and enthusiasm, he replaced it with another and kept on toward his goal. But he did not change his goal. After he had tried 9,999 plans, and all of these had failed, he did not say, "Oh well, what's the use? I will change my mind and build a machine that will peel potatoes instead." He went right ahead and chose the 10,000th plan, and lo, it was the one that worked. Edison's persistence and his belief that out there somewhere in the cosmos may be found the answer to all problems had projected into space the pattern of a definite idea, and that idea had found contact with a physical counterpart. By what strange alchemy this took place, no one, not even the great Edison, has ever been able to explain. Mr. Edison believed that life was something to be seized, harnessed, and ridden. He proved that no one is ever defeated until and unless he accepts defeat as such in his own mind. His partner, Edwin C. Barnes, proved that no one, not even a poor lad without pull and without railroad fare, need go without a job. Moreover, he proved that no one need accept a humble job at menial labor and remain at that job longer than is necessary to merit a better one. He chose, as his major purpose in life, a partnership with the great Edison, and made his choice become a splendid reality. Luck, chance, favorable breaks had nothing to do with his good fortune. It was of his own making, created in his own mind, carried out in his own mind. Not everyone can become a partner of the world's greatest men, but everyone can and should aim high at some definite goal, and then enthusiastically put heart and soul back of that aim until all obstacles melt away, or until obstacles can be transformed into stepping stones on which one may climb nearer the object of that aim. Mr. Edison is gone, but the simple principles that made him stand out from the crowd as the world's greatest inventor are as available today as they were when he found them and put them to work. And the greatest of these principles is enthusiastic singleness of purpose, plus concentration of effort on that purpose until it has been fully clothed in its physical or financial equivalent. All success begins in the form of an impulse of thought, an idea. Mr. Edison carried his ideas beyond the thought impulse stage by the simple process of placing back of them a burning desire, enthusiasm, for their realization. His obsession was invention, the most difficult, perhaps, and generally the least profitable of all occupations. But Mr. Edison accumulated a sizable fortune from his work, thus proving that definiteness of purpose, backed by enthusiasm, can create opportunity wherever one wills. How to develop the habit of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm, as the term is used in this chapter, describes the modus operandi by which the emotions of the heart and the reasoning power of the head may be combined in whatever proportion one desires. There are certain steps one may take that will lead to the development of the habit of enthusiasm, viz. 1. Adopt a definite major purpose. 2. Back that purpose with an obsessional desire, enthusiastic motive, for its attainment. 3. Create a definite plan or combinations of plans and begin immediately to carry them out, keeping in mind Mr. Carnegie's emphasis on the importance of coordination between the mind and the body through physical action. 4. Transfer both the purpose and the plan to the subconscious mind by writing them out clearly and repeating what you have written many times daily. 5. Follow through with persistence based on all the enthusiasm you can develop, remembering that a weak plan persistently applied is better than a strong plan applied intermittently or without enthusiasm. 6. Keep away from joy killers and confirmed pessimists. Their influence is deadly. Substitute in their place associates who are optimistic, and above all, do not mention your plans to anyone except those who are in full sympathy with you. 7. If the nature of your definite major purpose requires it, ally yourself with others whose aid you require. 8. When overtaken by defeat, study your plans carefully, and if need be, change them, but do not change your purpose. 9. Never let a day pass without having devoted some time, even if it be ever so little, to carrying out your plans. Remember, you are developing the habit of enthusiasm, and habits call for physical action. 10. Autosuggestion is a powerful factor in the development of any habit. Therefore, keep yourself sold on the belief that you will obtain the object of your definite major purpose, no matter how far removed from you the object of your purpose may be. Your own mental attitude will determine the nature of the action your subconscious mind will take in connection with your purpose. Keep your mind positive at all times, remembering that enthusiasm thrives only in a positive mind. It will not mix with fear, envy, greed, jealousy, revenge, hatred, intolerance, and procrastination. Enthusiasm thrives on action. From here on out, you're on your own. The next move is yours, and no one can make it for you. I can tell you what you must do to enjoy the power of enthusiasm, but I cannot help you do it. No one can help you but yourself and your mastermind allies, if you have such. Remember Mr. Carnegie's statement that enthusiasm is contagious, but remember also that pessimism is contagious. Cultivate personal associates who express enthusiasm, and be sure to include at least one such person in your mastermind group. Every person lives in two worlds: the world of his mental attitude, which is greatly influenced by his physical environment and his personal associates, and the physical world in which he must struggle for a living. The circumstances of the physical world may be greatly shaped by the way one relates himself to his mental world. This he can control. The physical world is beyond his control, except to the extent that he attracts that portion of it which harmonizes with his mental attitude. Enthusiasm is a great leavening force in one's mental world. It gives power to one's purposes. It makes for harmony within one's own mind. It helps to free the mind of negative influences. It wakes up the imagination and stirs one to action in shaping the circumstances of the physical world to his own needs. A man without enthusiasm or a definite major purpose resembles a locomotive without either steam or a track on which to run, or a destination toward which to travel. Enthusiasm is the action-producing factor of thought. Where it is lacking, its place usually is taken by the habit of procrastination. If you are one of the 98 persons out of every 100 who do not know what they want most, make it your business to find out what you want. Be definite in your decision. No amount of enthusiasm can take the place of definiteness of major purpose. If you do not know precisely what you demand of life, you may be sure that you will get nothing except that which life has left over, after those with a definite purpose get through choosing. The leftovers are not desirable. If you do know what you want, go after it now. Put everything you have into your efforts. Let your desire become obsessional so it will drive you instead of your driving it. If you are a citizen of the United States, you know that you live in a land of plenty. Plenty of opportunity. Plenty of material wealth. Plenty of demand for people who can render useful service. If you do not fit where you are, you can change. Experience has proved over and over again that a man can do pretty much anything he really wishes to do. Depressions have come and gone in the United States, many of them. Wars come and go. And men, both the successful and the unsuccessful, come and go. But the greatest nation on earth remains the land of greatest opportunity throughout all these changes. Somewhere your opportunity exists. Find it. Embrace it and make the most of it. Never minding the pessimists and the never-do-wells who, because of their own failure, try to convince others that this country should be torn asunder and built over. There is nothing wrong with this country except some of the people. Those who sincerely seek opportunity find it. They do not find it, however, by waiting to see what is going to happen. They find it by making something happen right where they stand, by acting on their own initiative in a spirit of unshakable faith in themselves and the future of their country. There is no opportunity in this country for the person who is willing to sell it short by listening to defeatists and professional propagandists. This country has always reserved its greatest opportunities for those who express the greatest faith in its future. It will continue to do the same. The man who takes his cue from a soapbox rabble-rouser and writes off his opportunity by allowing himself to be thus influenced deserves the loss that is sure to become his. The world does not reward unbelievers. It rewards those who have faith in infinite intelligence, faith in their fellow men, and faith in themselves. Enthusiasm inspires faith in self. The unbroken record of individual achievement through the opportunities provided by the American way of life should give one faith in the future of this country. I call attention to this spirit of defeatism which spread in the United States after the beginning of the business depression, and especially after the beginning of the Second World War, because it makes enthusiasm difficult. Defeatism is deadly to all who embrace it at any time, but it is more dangerous in war periods than it is when the conditions of the world are normal, because in emergency periods it is spread by professionals whose only object is to destroy the American way of life. One does not have to do anything or say anything to help these professional propagandists. One has only to allow his faith in his country to be undermined, his confidence in himself destroyed. Because the habit of enthusiasm prepares the way for an abiding faith, this principle deserves to be studied carefully and applied vigorously now, when the seeds of distrust are being so viciously sown throughout the nation. Do not be contented with reading this chapter, but appropriate its contents and put them into service, beginning with yourself and continuing by teaching others to supplant defeatism with faith. As Mr. Carnegie has stated, one never learns anything adequately until he begins to teach it to others. Mr. Carnegie also emphasized the importance of coordination of the mind and the body through appropriate physical action, as a practical means of developing the habit of enthusiasm. We are living in a world that is grief-stricken and mentally sick. We know that the cause of the sickness is the maladjustment in human relationships, and we know equally well that the philosophy of personal achievement offers the way to a better understanding. It has the answer to most of the problems that now confuse and embarrass people in every walk of life. This has been proved by the astounding record of the philosophy in the past, even before it was fully tested and prepared for the people in its present form. The philosophy of American achievement is rapidly becoming the standard guide in human relationships in almost every walk of life, among people of all races and creeds. It has found its way into the sales organizations of outstanding life insurance companies, and it is doing full-time duty for employer and employee alike in banks, retail stores, and industrial plants, all of whom have found in it a common meeting ground on which they can negotiate with full assurance that it will benefit alike all whom it serves. In view of all the highly organized endeavor to divide and control the people of America that is going on throughout the nation, most of which is aimed at destroying the working relationship between employers and employees, it is encouraging to know that this philosophy is serving as an antidote for this un-American, destructive endeavor. In the closing pages of his book, Adventures of a White-Collar Man, Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., president of General Motors, gives a striking illustration of the part this sort of philosophy has played in the success of that industrial empire. In his own terminology, he describes the General Motors operating philosophy as follows. Management, the collective effort, mastermind principle, of intelligence, experience, and imagination. The facts, a constant search for the truth, organized thought. The open mind, policy based upon analysis without prejudice, liberty of thought, tolerance. Courage, the willingness to take a risk, recognizing the fact that leadership exacts a price. Organized individual endeavor, applied faith. Equity, respect for the rights of others, the golden rule applied. Confidence, the courage of one's convictions, applied faith. Self-discipline. Loyalty, the willingness to make any sacrifice for the cause. Going the extra mile, doing more than one is paid for. Progress, there must always be a better way. Creative vision. Work, the catalyst, acceleration, that energizes all these ingredients so that they may take their respective parts in promoting the common cause. Organized individual endeavor. Thus we see that Mr. Sloan has mentioned several of the principles of the philosophy of American achievement as being the foundation of the business philosophy of the great General Motors Industrial Organization. Such are the basic principles that I laid down, said Mr. Sloan, as my platform for the guidance of the organization at the time I became president of General Motors Corporation. As the years have passed, he continued, they have been my constant guide. They have never failed in the many moments of stress and doubt. I am sure they will never fail any individual or organization, irrespective of the problems or the difficulties that must be faced. Bill Knutson and I were sitting in the press club of the General Motors building at New York World's Fair. We had just celebrated its opening. 1,000 distinguished guests had seen the exhibit and had taken a ride through the Futurama. We had had dinner. A moving picture had been shown, dramatizing the recent accomplishments of American industry in the form of new things, methods, processes, and products. Every individual enterprise represented, and many others as well, had contributed to a symposium of progress. It was a stupendous record of accomplishment, especially in the face of a long period of depression. Everyone was electrified by what had been seen and heard. I realized that, in many ways, it was a new top in our evolution. Here were shown all our products, dressed in the very latest technical mode. A great array of devices dedicated to better living, making possible a wider horizon of contact and enjoyment. You know, Bill, I said to Mr. Knudsen, all these products really tell the story of the American plan of free enterprise. The ceaseless research in the hope of producing more and better goods and services at ever greater values. They are symbolic of American industry today. The industrial scheme of things that is constantly turning luxuries into everyday conveniences for more people. And what we must never forget in this country, said Knudsen, is that the only way to provide more jobs for people is to keep on doing the things that made all these things possible, only do them still better. Quality products, better methods, good wages, low prices, better tools, fair dealing, and, he added, plenty of hard work from everybody. Just think, Bill, I said. The wonder of it all is that we have only just begun. The opportunities for America are beyond the dreams of any man now alive. If we will only, through persistent work and enterprise, continue the pattern that was begun so long ago. Take the Futurama, for instance, a conception of what the world of 1960 may look like. But who knows what the world of 1960 really will be like? The real world of tomorrow will outstrip anything we can imagine today, if only we in this country will keep our vision and hold our faith in the fundamentals that make for progress. New comforts for the city, a new life for the country, conveniences in the home, progress in better living, new highways, new means of communication, strides in health and education and culture. The mind of man just cannot comprehend all the things that lie within our reach. This philosophy will do more to antidote the vicious spirit of defeatism than anything we can imagine. Skilled technicians and scientists are working continuously in the research laboratories of such concerns as General Electric Company, General Motors Corporation, Ford Motor Company, and United States Steel Corporation, where huge sums are being spent annually in search of new and better ways of doing things. These men are not working aimlessly with the hope of coming upon information of value, but they are searching for definite information on specific subjects. Here you will find the philosophy of American achievement in operation in its highest and most commendable form. The American way of life provides an abundance of opportunity for the person who makes these success principles a part of his daily routine and, as Mr. Sloan has so well stated, the opportunities for America are beyond the dreams of any man now alive, if we will only, through persistent work and enterprise, continue the pattern that was begun so long ago. He might well have added, if we will continue the pattern that was begun so long ago, in the same spirit of enthusiasm and faith that this pattern was created by those who have gone before us. This sentiment reminds me of a statement made by Andrew Carnegie while he was helping me organize this philosophy. Biz. Never worry about the lack of opportunities in America. If you must worry, let it be in connection with a lack of ambition, the lack of enthusiasm, the lack of creative vision, which are so essential in embracing opportunities. We have not even scratched the surface of American opportunities. The possibilities of future achievement in this country are so far ahead of past accomplishments that there is hardly room for comparison. We have more natural resources than any country in the world. We have more private wealth per capita than any nation in the world. We have the highest standard of living known to civilization. Yet, with all these advantages, we have just begun to make use of our opportunities. We can lead the world in industry, science, education, and culture if only we can produce enough leaders to inspire the people of America to take the fullest advantage of their privileges and opportunities. When Mr. Carnegie looked ahead into the future and made this statement, we had no radio, no great system of improved highways, no great automobile industry, no Federal Reserve banking system, no refrigerators within the means of the humblest householder, and wages were but a fraction of what they are today. Therefore, in the light of what has happened in this country in the brief span of a little over 30 years, which has more than justified Mr. Carnegie's prophecy as to the future of America, we have sound reason for looking ahead into the future and prophesying that the accomplishments of the next 30 years will make those of the past 30 years look insignificant by comparison. The fruits of these future accomplishments will be the work of men and women who master and apply this philosophy. Likewise, they will belong to those who have the foresight and the ambition to apply the philosophy. It has been that way in the past. It will be that way in the future. Opportunity, in a free country such as ours, belongs to the man who moves on his own initiative in a spirit of enthusiasm backed by faith. Nothing can change this except the spirit of defeatism, which is being infiltrated into this country by envious nations whose leaders would like to enjoy our benefits without giving anything in return for them. Personal enthusiasm, definiteness of purpose, self-reliance, personal initiative, and personal ambition can kill off this spirit of defeatism. The future of America justifies anyone in developing enthusiasm. That is why men of vision, such men as Alfred P. Sloan Jr. and Henry Ford and Owen D. Young, the heads of the great life insurance companies and the builders of airplanes such as Eddie Rickenbacker, pay no attention to the philosophy of defeatism, but go right ahead with expansion programs that demonstrate their faith in the future of this country. And that is why the research laboratories of the great industrial firms of America are working day and night, preparing ways and means of developing the future and helping the people to make the most of it. The future of America, as seen through the eyes of one outstanding scientist, was briefly described a little while ago by William D. Coolidge, director of research of the General Electric Laboratories, in these words. The other day, a newspaper man told me that $1 million awaits the one who discovers a swifter way to make newspaper engravings. I can tell you how to go about it. Find a ray which, when projected through a photographic negative onto a plate, will quickly etch out the plate. But I can't tell you what ray to use, nor what plate. Another million should go to the man who invents a simple, cheap way to make good paper prints of color photographs. The word